Hello and welcome back to another episode of Citizen Bitcoin, the show where we help you along that path to becoming a good citizen of Bitcoin, a sovereign citizen of Bitcoin, a holder of your private keys and your own wealth, censorship resistant wealth. Tommy, it's my birthday today.
It's your birthday? You didn't tell me it was your
birthday. Birthday podcast.
It's his birthday, boy. Happy birthday.
All right. And that's thinking back to last year, around my birthday, this is when...
I forgot. You told me it was your birthday a couple days ago.
Yeah.
We're going to go watch the Arsenal-Atletico Madrid match.
Birthday lunch. Looking forward.
Birthday lunch, which should be pretty good.
Looking forward
Arsenal,
to
baby. Go Gunners.
Looking forward to some Europa League action today. All right. So it reminded me that last year around this time was when I started becoming aware of Bitcoin again. Of course, I kind of had some touch points over the years with it. And I remember looking back, so I saw it again. The price started rising about this time last year and caught my attention again. And I started watching it. I bought a little bit of Bitcoin toward the end of May last year.
It was under 3,000, wasn't it? It was 1,800 to 3,000?
Yeah. Right around now, I think it was.
Yeah, there were some people that. It was about the time when a bunch of people declared it dead. Which, that's happening again now, but anyway, yeah.
Yeah, it broke an all-time high, the previous all-time high from 2013, I guess. And so started getting some attention and started watching it. So it's been almost a year now that I've been really seriously into Bitcoin. And it's, wow, what a year it's been. What a year it's been. Quite a ride from the end of the summer through the fall, through the winter, up to that mania peak of almost 20 grand per coin. Then the alt season came on, and then of course the bear market, which we hopefully have seen the bottom in now, about 6,500.
But we have a low time preference, so that's okay.
Oh yeah, this is all just entertainment at this point. It's the nice thing about being low time preference, not really. Caring too much about what the short term is. Low stress, strong hands. So, glad you're here today, and we're excited to continue to share our journey learning Bitcoin, hoping it makes your journey a little bit easier. You can find us on Twitter at Citizen Bitcoin, Medium at Citizen Bitcoin, and we've got the YouTube version of the show where you can see the tabs that we're working from. And the information we're showing on the screen, audio only, podcast. You can find that at citizenbitcoin.simplecast.fm. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts, wherever you get your podcasts. Just search for Citizen Bitcoin in your podcast app. All right, so today we're actually going to take a break from focusing on Bitcoin and take a look at, well, we'll definitely be talking Bitcoin, but we take a kind of a holistic view of the ecosystem here, and while we focus on Bitcoin, believing that it's the driver of this entire space of the crypto economy, and is the coin that has the best, clearly the best long-term potential in our opinion, it's also very important to stay aware of the other players, especially the more serious players. Ethereum is certainly one of those.
Well, and Ethereum's got some significant issues right now, in terms of which is what we're going to cover, and also just get into Ethereum a little bit because it's important to understand Ethereum as it relates to this whole situation. Our preference would be that Ethereum would be able to be lockstep with Bitcoin in order to grow the entire crypto asset area. It's just that there's some there's a couple things we're going to cover on Ethereum which are problematic, we think. So.
Yeah, and I think long term, I'm becoming more and more of a Bitcoin maximalist as the days go by. In fact, when I first started getting back into Bitcoin, I discovered Ethereum. I hadn't even heard of it really until about a year ago. And, you know, I fanboyed pretty hard for a while on Ethereum. I think you probably remember that.
Yeah.
Watching Vitalik all over, basically all his YouTube videos talking about Ethereum.
Yeah, it's kind of similar to your fanboy with Elon Musk.
It's It's a little bit similar.
Tesla, except that's, you know, we would have to have a whole different show, but we were discussing...
I got out of Tesla a couple months ago, so
yeah,
I timed that one.
Yeah,
well.
So in terms of skin in the game, so, you know, our view, my view on Tesla, which is I'm a Tesla skeptic, is particularly confirmed after yesterday's earnings call and yesterday's earnings release. So anyway,
we'll see what happens. Tommy thinks... it's going to be a pretty spectacular blow-up for Tesla sometime this year, as he likes to...
More or less later in the year.
He and his Twitter buddy, Mark Yusko, like to hashtag no skid marks. They're not even going to try to stop. They're just going to plow into that wall full speed. No skid marks.
Yeah, that's right. And that's Mark's. And there's also another very, very good person on Tesla, Charlie Grant, which is a Wall Street Journal herd. He's fantastic.
All right, so yeah, so I was fanboying pretty hard on Ethereum for a while there, and you know, over the year transitioned more and more into agreeing with the Bitcoin maximalist argument that we'll have one winner, one major winner. There might be some tokens that sort of fill in the space on the long tail, but this is at least an 80-20 situation where Bitcoin will get, you know, the winner or will get 80% of at least of the action. But you know, maybe even there's an argument that's understandable to say that it'll be close to 100%, if not exactly 100%, because how many people are using TCPIP alternatives right now?
And the issue with Ethereum, and this is generally getting into, is you have a situation with Ethereum where it's a pre-mine, right? I mean, it's pretty much a pre-mine coin.
What is a pre-mining, Tommy?
Well,
what do you mean by that?
Well, it's not. Well, if you look at Bitcoin just started from nothing and grew out and it's a software, and you had developers that developed it. A pre-mine is that you have the amounts set without any type of mining, and it's a group that
before the coin starts to be mined for distribution, right?
Yep.
of the coin, there are investors who are able to buy the token before it starts being mined, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's a pre-mine.
Yep.
Right. And of course, when Bitcoin launched, it just, you know, Satoshi put the code out and started mining it. I think Hal Finney was the second person to start mining it, and just grew organically from there.
So there was nobody putting any money into it. It just grew organically.
There's no central organization. There's no Bitcoin Foundation.
Ethereum, and another pre-mine was Ripple. So you have a situation where you have these investors that have a stake, and also have made a lot of money off of it. There are also incentives with these particular investors. But the issue you have with Ethereum right now that's important is with respect to Silicon Valley, and in terms of a lot of the foundational applications and tokens and a lot of work underlying a whole host of different types of businesses, let's say, or ventures, mm-hmm. the underlying basis, there was a bet made on Ethereum as that being the underlying basis.
So there's some powerful interests who, you know, want to see it.
And one of the reasons why they didn't pick Bitcoin is that Ethereum was easier to utilize. And
well,
also
it was easier for them to get a significant holding, right? I mean, mm-hmm. Bitcoin was kind of already, it was more established.
Mm-hmm.
Ethereum was extremely cheap, extremely new. So this was an opportunity for them to get into something that could potentially disrupt Bitcoin. Was the narrative that they were creating, and get in very early so that they could have some control.
Right. So you have a situation where, and I'm jumping forward. And again, remember on this show, we're going back and forth here because we're attempting to learn, but also making sure we give you the correct information. We think part of the show, in terms of us going back and forth like that, also helps people get a view or determine, you know, where we are with this.
And of course, just to make clear, we're not, you know, financial advisors, we're not professionals here, just a couple of guys researching and learning about Bitcoin on our own. You need to do the same thing, but we're here to share our information and hopefully make your journey a bit easier. But make sure you do your research, not investment advice.
Right. And so the other thing, and then we'll get directly into the whole issue of whether Bitcoin's, not Bitcoin, Ethereum is a security or not. It's pretty much been determined that Bitcoin, because of the way it was set up, there's no investors.
Yeah.
And it was set up, well, de novo, or just from scratch. And so
there's no other coin can really replicate that at this point.
I think it's beyond significant. I mean, yeah. It pretty much sets it as the cornerstone or the fundamental basis or bedrock of crypto assets.
So this particular aspect of Ethereum and Ripple, that there was a pre-mined situation where there was a centralized authority or entity. In Ripple's case, the Ripple Corporation. In Ethereum's case, the Ethereum Foundation, that basically launched or made an initial offering of these currencies or tokens. And so now the SEC is looking closely at, and the CFTC and other regulatory bodies in the United States and around the world are looking closely at Ethereum and similar pre-mine offerings, token offerings, and examining whether or not they're non-compliant securities. There's a debate going on now.
So just from a real simple perspective, is the whole notion of crypto assets is that they're supposed to be, or I mean the way we look at it, independent. And so you have a situation right here where you've got Ripple and Ethereum, and you've got government regulatory bodies trying to determine whether they're decentralized or not.
Yeah. So the argument is...
So it's a situation where, okay, so you've got a coin where you're basically saying, hey, you know what? We got to prove that we're, you know, to the government regulatory bodies, we got to get lobbyists out there, and we got to try to force it so it goes our way.
And so one of the main investors in Ethereum is a VC firm called Andreessen Horowitz, famous mm-hmm. VC firm, Mark Andreessen, Ben Horowitz.
Exceptional, a top exceptional firm.
Right. Very well respected and very successful in the VC game. They have led a group of other investors who hold an interest in Ethereum to lobby the regulatory bodies in the United States, saying that Ethereum, although maybe at the when it was initially offered its ICO, was perhaps centralized at that point. Maybe it was a non-compliant security at that point. But since then, has sufficiently decentralized so that it is not a non-compliant security now. It is a decentralized cryptocurrency similar to Bitcoin.
So you end up saying, well, what does that really mean? I mean, from the standpoint of decentralized, because if you go actually into Ethereum at its very base level, you have an ongoing discussion right now of going from proof of work to proof of stake. Mm-hmm. But then you turn around and say, well, if enough of these projects have been distributed around, is that enough to define it as decentralized? Well, I personally, a couple days ago, was just wholeheartedly all in saying, nope, it's absolutely a security. And then the more I'm looking at this aspect of all these new projects and spread out, and there's a situation, I think we're probably going to cover it, in terms of these tokens relative to the original Ethereum. There's a separation there. I've opened my mind on it again. I'm not really certain at this point. So
the debate that's going on is sort of being spearheaded by Preston Byrne, who is a England-based, UK-based lawyer.
Well, he's originally from England, but I believe he's actually in the U.S.
Okay.
But
he was trained in English law, right?
100% English law. And okay. My understanding, and I'm pretty certain on this, is that Mr. Byrne is in the process of being able to practice law in the U.S.
I see.
So I think he's either finished or close to finishing law school.
All right. So
and I don't know how much you follow him, but I highly regard his views. He's been into this for a while. He also was either the chief operating officer or one of the top players in a firm that's involved in the space prior to deciding to go back and get his U.S.
Right. So there's one side of the debate leaning toward Ether is a non-compliant security and kind of being led and spearheaded by Preston Byrne. And then the other side of the debate, saying that Ether is not a security, being spearheaded by Peter Van Valkenburg, who is a employed at CoinDesk, a lobbyist organization that lobbies in favor of crypto assets.
The point earlier, there you have a lobbyist. So you need to get a lobbyist to try to figure out whether you're, you know, a security or not, in my view is not good. But go to the top, please.
Yeah.
So this is the point, understanding the difference between a token pre-sale and the token itself.
So let's just a quick kind of summary of Valkenburg's position versus Byrne's position.
Yes.
So Valkenburg is saying that that Ethereum as it exists today is not a security, right? And so Gensler, who was, and we had this pulled up at the beginning here, Gary Gensler, who's a former financial regulator for President Obama, spoke out regarding regulatory status of Ether and Ripple last week in an interview with the New York Times. He said that, quote, there is a strong case for both of them, Ethereum and Ripple, but particularly Ripple, that they are non-compliant securities. And I agree with him there that Ripple is more clearly a non-compliant security than Ethereum, and that there's more of a debate to be had with Ethereum. That quote is what prompted, Valkenburg's response.
Right, and while we're at it, on Ripple, it's a situation, at some point we may cover Ripple, but it's a situation where we'd rather
Ripple's a dumpster fire, man.
Yeah, we would rather just spend our time more wisely and not waste our time talking about Ripple. In fact, we've already talked about it too much already.
There we go, yeah. So Gensler is and Byrne and that side of the debate are saying that, you know, the Ethereum Foundation in 2014 was basically the central entity controlling Ethereum. You know, the Ethereum Foundation and Vitalik Buterin, the founder of Ethereum. And then the Ethereum network as a whole today is different, right? It's now much more decentralized. So reliance, I'll just read from Valkenburg here. Reliance on the efforts of a promoter is a key prong of the Howey test. The Howey test being the guide for defining whether or not something is a security in the United States. It's based on a court case that involved someone named Howey and like orange groves in Florida, I think. So that's one of the key prongs of the Howey test is the efforts of a central promoter. So in a token presale, there's a reliance on an issuer, and maybe the Ethereum Foundation in 2014 fits that bill. But today, the value of Ether and the functionality of Ethereum network is not reliant on the foundation. Rather, it flows from the efforts of thousands of unaffiliated developers, miners, and users. That decentralization is hard to differentiate from Bitcoin's. A cryptocurrency, Gensler suggests, is almost certainly not a security for the very reason we're discussing. No discernible third party, no common enterprise upon whom we can rely for the expectation of profits. So the argument is essentially that Ethereum is now sufficiently decentralized. It is like Bitcoin now, and at this point, it is not a non-compliant security.
Well, right? Except, you know, the one thing I'd point out, though, is except that the original people in on the gig, on the pre-mine, they are substantially benefit by this becoming, being determined that it's not a security.
Right. So,
and Bitcoin has nothing to do with that because there's no original, it started de novo.
Valkenburg goes on to say that it's possible for a useful decentralized token to not be a security even if it originated in a presale or ICO that qualified as a security issuance at the point of the presale, which is kind of confusing, right? So here's the sort of leap, the logical leap that he makes. He says that securities are legal relationships between issuers and investors. They're not the paper on which the contract or other legal relationship is printed, nor are securities the spreadsheet entries that demark fractional ownership of a business, nor are securities any of the ones or zeros, the arrangement of which may represent the terms of the deal. So then they're not the digital version of the paper securities as well. Nor are securities the assets that are derived from the investment deal. Just because Apple uses invested money to build iPhones doesn't mean that the iPhones themselves are securities, right? So he's trying to separate the Ether token from its origin with this kind of being offered by the central authority of the Ethereum Foundation. All right, so Preston Byrne goes against that and says that he doesn't believe that Ethereum's promoters and Orbital Labs promoters have satisfactorily answered the decentralization question to date, and that the onus is on them to prove that rather than the opposite way, right?
Mm-hmm.
So what happens is they look back at the pre-sale, okay? And what's interesting is they found that the distribution of the pre-sale purchases, all right? And there's a graph here that we're looking at for those of you on the podcast, and this link will be, of course, in the show notes. But there's a graph that's sort of rises up, flattens out, and then rises up again, but it's really perfect.
It's an S-curve.
It's an S-curve that's almost perfect, okay? And then if you look at some graphs of other sort of pre-sales or fundraising efforts, so here's a Kickstarter graph. You know, it's much more, erratic, kind of organic.
And it just kind of goes straight up a hill, right?
Gradual growth. All right, here is the sale of Tezos tokens, which also is an S-curve, but it's not nearly as perfect as the Ethereum pre-sale S-curve. And so the implication is that maybe the Ethereum Foundation or some other centralized, organization a group or something, but in this case probably the foundation itself, understood or sort of saw where Ethereum was going, that it was going to transition to proof of stake eventually. And when you're in a proof of stake cryptocurrency, you want to own as much of it as possible, because the stake that you have in the cryptocurrency is what gives you power in that system, in that ecosystem, right? So if there was some kind of program,
Key here is, and maybe we've mentioned this before, but proof of work is stalwart. It's bedrock. Proof of stake is not. It's just it's a weaker form underlying a crypto asset.
Arguably less secure. But maybe if there was some kind of bot that was being run by the Ethereum Foundation that was designed to purchase Ether along that mathematical curve, mm-hmm. right? And that's why it looks so perfect. So the implication being that the Ethereum Foundation has far more Ether than anyone thinks they do, and so it's still a centralized entity at this point in terms of control, especially if it moves to a proof of stake mm-hmm. Consensus system as is planned. So questions out there about Ethereum, and another thing that we should talk about is the security of the Ethereum platform, right? And we know that there's been some big smart contract hacks, and one of the major sort of differentiation that Ethereum offered when it was launched was, all right, we're going to be Bitcoin but with smart contracts. This idea of Turing complete smart contracts, any kind of computation that you can another system can be done on the Ethereum platform.
Exactly, and the other part of it is what Silicon Valley primarily went with is they said, we're going to use Ethereum because we have these smart contracts, so yep. we can build all these businesses or ideas off of Ethereum, and we're not going to go with Bitcoin.
Yeah.
And Bitcoin now has a situation where it's fledgling, but you can do smart contracts, but it's still it's still
RSK,
early with
rootstock is Turing complete smart contracts on a sidechain of Bitcoin. And this is something we keep coming back to as well, is this is programmable money. This is software. So, Bitcoin can adopt the best attributes or features of its competitors or alternatives. And so it's going to
but
be
you,
so
but
hard.
But you make up a great point here in terms of being hacked. And you also, yeah. There's a discussion going on right now about that there was an issue where they're looking at on Ethereum where a group is looking at somehow trying to hard fork or go back to get their cash back. And
right.
It's tens of millions of dollars.
Yeah, just to give a quick look back at history. So, of course, this happened with the DAO as well, which was the granddaddy of all Ethereum hacks. And so the distributed autonomous organization, which is comprised of a series of smart contracts intended to democratize how Ethereum projects were funded. So they called it the DAO or DAO, the Distributed Autonomous Organization. This was back in June of 2016 that the DAO was raising funds. And during the fundraise, it was hacked. And 3.6 million Ether, or 15% of all the Ether in circulation at the time, was drained from the smart contracts, exploiting a code vulnerability. And
now just think about that.
Yeah.
Now this is Ethereum, okay?
15% of all
this happened to Ethereum in the history of Ethereum.
Yeah, just
this actually happened
less than 2 years ago. Year and a half. Right. Year.
And another thing, just to be clear, and why we get all wound up and so talking about Bitcoin is the fact that Bitcoin has never been hacked.
Right.
In the history.
So the only way to recover the funds from that hack, which was devastating for Ethereum. And effectively go back in time, was for the Ethereum's code base itself to be reset through a hard fork in the blockchain. And so that's why we have Ethereum Classic now. So the community led by Vitalik Buterin decided to hard fork off of the blockchain that was hacked, go back in time, rewind, and undo the hack, basically redistribute all of those funds back to their original owners. Ethereum Classic said, look, immutability is important, not changing the history of the blockchain is important, and so we're going to continue the original Ethereum blockchain as Ethereum Classic, and we're going to retain the mantle of immutability. And Bitcoin is also immutable and it's never been.
Well, but see, that's the other thing as it relates to Ethereum is if you look at it, you usually want to be able to say, okay, so Ethereum, are you completely immutable? Have you ever had an issue? And it's like, well, yes, we had an issue once, and this is what happened.
Right.
So then you say, as of today going forward, can you say that just us looking at it objectively? Can we say, will the same group do that again?
And it happened again, and not too long ago. Parity is an Ethereum wallet, and last year there was a freeze of a bunch of funds because of a bug in the Parity wallet smart contract, and it froze more than almost 500,000 ETH inside this wallet. So it's not lost, it wasn't stolen, but it's frozen and can't be retrieved, and that ether is gone unless there's another hard fork.
And what? So just so our listeners and viewers, 500,000 ETH is roughly how much?
I don't know what the conversion rate is right now.
Well, what's the ETH right now? Do we know?
I don't even know. I haven't been keeping track.
I haven't either.
It doesn't really matter. The point is,
well, it's just
it's a lot of money.
Yeah, I'll look it up real. Keep going. I'll look it up real quick. But right. I mean, it's a lot of dough. I mean, it's not like we're playing with kids with this amount of money we're talking about.
Right. And the point is, it's going to happen again and again. Once you've hard forked
roughly $750.
Yeah.
Times a 500,000.
Yeah. Once the ledger has been changed, there's going to be pressure to do it again in situations when it inevitably happens again like this. And there is pressure on Vitalik to go back and unfreeze these funds with another hard fork. And there was a big hack last week as well to some ERC-20 tokens. Somebody found a loophole in the contract and created tokens that were worth 5 octodecillion, which is something like 5 followed by like 60 zeros or something like that, US dollars. Obviously just impossible, but it was another hack or another mistake in smart contract. So unreliable.
But the point, though,
not immutable any longer.
Yeah, well, that happened, and the whole thing is there wasn't a stop sign up that said, oh, wait a second, wash this through, it's not going to happen. This actually impacted and hit Ethereum. So you really have to say, sitting back from it, say, well, why would you, starting right now, have anything to do with Ethereum?
Yeah.
And then you have a situation where we go back, I'm going backwards here, but you go in a situation with this whole idea of whether it's a security or it's not a security. Well, not only do you have that issue, and if it becomes deemed a security, it's going to wipe out all sorts of value. Okay.
Right.
And then you not only have that, is the immutability issue is not even solved. So if you had a situation where you were an investor and you invested in somebody and said they were going to go ahead and do something, have a nice new thing, and then later on you would figure, okay, well, they're going to use the right underlying crypto asset, and then they go ahead and use Ethereum, and you might say, well, why did you use Ethereum? I mean, you knew all this stuff was going on. Why didn't you use something else?
Right. Yeah, so definitely some questions that have not really been answered sufficiently by the Ethereum community. It's a platform that's less reliable. It's now been, you know, it's been changed and hard forked to undo a hack. It's going to happen again at some point. It's more centralized than Bitcoin. There's just a lot more risk investing in Ethereum, in my opinion, than in Bitcoin. Again, not investment advice, our personal opinion. Do your own research. And so that's a summary of Ethereum.
And it's our opinion. Well, yeah, the only thing I've got is that I guess our opinion on Bitcoin's a little bit more hardcore, because we're basically saying that the whole crux of these crypto assets is immutability, right? And cryptographically being anonymous and just being solid, really solid, above reproach. Bitcoin, we know right now, is that case. And there's nobody that's even remotely close. So it's almost, you can go ahead and try to cut corners or whatever, right? But by using something else. But I agree with you.
Yeah. All right. That's all we have for today's show. Thanks for tuning in. And we will see you next time. Take care.
Thank you.
All right.